Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and with us now is New York Times columnist Nicholas Kristof. He has performed a great service by not letting the genocide of the Rohingya people taking place in Myanmar completely fall off the media's radar screen. You know, we can get so consumed with everything that feels so urgent, close to home, school shootings, jobs, everything about Trump, that we can lose sight of the worst things in the world that may be happening in places we consider remote. So Nick's article in the Sunday Review is called "I Saw a Genocide in Slow Motion." It's reporting from his fourth trip to Myanmar in 4 years to document this horror. We'll talk about this and touch a bit on some of his other recent columns, like his proposal for a better way to fight gun violence, and maybe touch on China, a long interest of Nicholas Kristof's, where Xi Jinping seems to be grabbing for the title president for life. But Nick, thanks for coming on again. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you. Good to be with you, Brian.
So for people not engaged in this story yet, remind us of the big picture. Who are the Rohingya, and why have you gone on four reporting trips to Myanmar in 4 years?
So they're an ethnic and religious minority in the western part of Myanmar. And they've always been marginalized, but since democracy has more or less come to Myanmar, they've been particularly targeted, partly because democratic politicians realize that they can make political hay from denouncing them. And also, as the internet has come more to Myanmar, then Facebook and other apps have been used to vilify the Rohingya. And so there have been periodic pogroms in the past against them, but the worst began late last August, when there was a incipient rebellion by a small Rohingya armed group, and the army just responded with a brutal scorched earth counterinsurgency, burning villages, raping women, killing boys, men, throwing babies into bonfires. And so about 700,000 Rohingya fled across the border into Bangladesh, but there were maybe 500,000 or so left behind. And the Myanmar government has denied humanitarian access to help those people. They've been confined to their villages or to a concentration camp. And so the purpose of my trip was to try to figure out what is happening to some of those left behind.
Genocide is such a grave thing. Maybe it's like the heaviest thing in human interaction of any kind. You used to call this situation ethnic cleansing, which is horrific enough. Why do you now use the G word?
So, you know, I think we shouldn't lightly use the word genocide, but when you come across villages that have been systematically destroyed by the army, by people carrying out orders, by, you know, seeing just about every male in the village shot dead, the women systematically gang raped, the babies having their throats cut or tossed into bonfires. And then when you have a government policy of denying humanitarian access, denying medical care to the survivors, in some cases denying food assistance, that's kind of the standard genocide approach that governments have used toward a besieged minority. And will the hard part legally in determining a genocide is to determine intent. And so that will have to wait some kind of a legal proceeding. But I'd say many human rights observers in the last couple of years, and me too, we've increasingly come to feel that this is probably a genocide that is unfolding before us.
So you describe, and you just referred to, a genocide in slow motion. It's about denying food and medical care more than killing with machetes and guns?
Yeah, the killing with machetes and guns, for the most part, stopped after the the sudden spree of violence last August and September. And so since then, the Rohingya have been confined to their villages, and for the most part, they're not being mowed down with machine guns right now. But aid groups are not allowed to bring them assistance, and they're not allowed to get any medical care. So one of the people that I visited was a woman, Sonowara, and the day before I visited, she had delivered twins. It was her first pregnancy. She's 18. She desperately needed some kind of medical help. And without being able to access that, she managed to survive, but both of her twins died. And and nearby, I spoke to a husband who had just lost his wife in childbirth as well. And this is, you know, completely unnecessary. There are aid groups that are willing to provide assistance. This is just gratuitous cruelty to try to make life unbearable for the Rohingya and encourage them to flee the country. And this is happening under a Nobel Peace Prize winner, of course, Aung San Suu Kyi, presiding over the country.
And I want to get to Aung San Suu Kyi in just a second. I want to invite our listeners in first. Anything you want to say or ask of Nicholas Kristof about the genocide of the Rohingya or any of his other recent columns, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And you name in your piece Myanmar's leader Aung San Suu Kyi, who once won the Nobel Peace Prize for running a nonviolent democracy movement when the country was under authoritarian rule. Now she presides over genocide. Did she change, or was the world wrong about her all along?
My guess is that both are true. I think she was probably always more of a Burman nationalist than of somebody who was really supporting human rights of all peoples. But I think in addition that she evolved into becoming a politician, and she realized that if she had anything nice to say about the Rohingya, that would cost her party votes. And so she became an opportunist. And right now in Myanmar, to show is just lethal politically in Myanmar.
Is Aung San Suu Kyi presently a democratically elected leader? Is a hard lesson here that democratically elected governments and genocidal governments are not mutually exclusive?
So she is barred from holding from actually leading the government as such by the military, but her party won the elections, and so she is the most powerful figure in the government. She does not control the army. They have their own domain, but she dominates the government, and she has been complicit in the army's slaughter, the army's rampages through the Rohingya areas. She has defended it. She's blamed aid groups. When a Rohingya woman came forward to talk about having been raped by the army, she denounced it as fake rape. And right now there are two Reuters reporters who were imprisoned for reporting on these massacres. And her government has prosecuted them, and now they're facing up to 14 years in prison. So it's not exactly as if Suu Kyi herself is ordering these massacres, but she is playing a central role not only in defending them, but actually in denying humanitarian access and continuing these policies.
You bring up the Reuters journalists who are now in prison for trying to report the story, and they keep journalists out, or they try to. So how much of your trip was an act of stealth?
It was entirely stealth. I could not get a journalist visa into Myanmar because I've written about these issues. The Myanmar government is not my biggest fan. But as it happened, I was leading a New York Times tour to Myanmar. My segment was ending in Myanmar. So that got me a tourist visa. And then I left the tour and just tried to stay below the radar, and went to the Rohingya areas and tried to avoid the checkpoints. I had a car with tinted windows. I at one point took a boat to get around various checkpoints, and some local people were quite helpful in telling me what paths to take to avoid those checkpoints.
Diana in New Rochelle, you're on WNYC with New York Times columnist Nicholas Kristof. Hi.
Hi. I read your column on Sunday, Nicholas, and was so horrified. I know you report on these, and I think that Aung San Suu Kyi should be tried as a war criminal, and her Nobel Peace Prize should be rescinded. She is just as culpable as the army that is going in and doing these atrocities, and it is a genocide. And you point out that they're not allowing aid workers in. What can we do? What kind of pressure can we bring to bear, and who should we contact to do this, to bring some pressure on their government and to remove her and affect some sort of change? And do you and your wife still have some sort of an organization that we can work with?
So thanks for your queries and great question on the on where we find pressure. And I should say that my wife and I are, we're still writing books, this kind of thing, but we try to refer people to other organizations rather than to have our own organization. And so human rights groups are doing a fantastic job trying to call attention to what is going on. There is one that is focused on Myanmar that is called Fortify Rights, but Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International are also doing just a superb job on this. One of the problems is that we in the U.S. really don't have much leverage over Myanmar, partly because China protects it in the U.N. Security Council. But I do think that, we have some influence and that we can raise the cost of these kinds of atrocities with naming and shaming. And Secretary of State Tillerson has indeed referred to ethnic cleansing, which was great. The White House has been completely silent on this. And I think that maybe the best leverage we would have is targeted sanctions on Myanmar leaders. I would not favor general sanctions on all of Myanmar, because then ordinary citizens, many of them poor, would pay the price. But targeted sanctions on the leaders, I think, maybe the best approach, and that was the approach that ultimately got the military to back down and allow the recent elections. There is legislation in both the House and the Senate that would apply targeted sanctions. In the Senate, it's backed by Senators Durbin and McCain. It's bipartisan. It got through the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. And for reasons that I don't fully understand, Mitch McConnell is currently holding it up. So I would encourage people to, ask their House member or their senators to back the legislation for targeted sanctions on Myanmar.
We'll continue in a minute with New York Times columnist Nicholas Kristof, Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Brian Lehrer on WNYC with New York Times columnist Nicholas Kristof, just back from his fourth reporting trip in 4 years to Myanmar to document the ethnic cleansing, he used to call it. Now he uses the word genocide against the Rohingya people there. We'll also get into some of Nick's other recent columns on other things, but let's take another phone call on this. Fitzcarl in Miami, you're on WNYC with Nicholas Kristof. Hi there.
Hi, Brian. Sad to hear all of this. Mr. Kristof, I have a question for you. Does Buddhism, the belief of, Myanmar, most of the people, not play any factor in checking people's, what has been done to the Rohingya people at all? Like, does Buddhism at all count? Like, what's going on? It's supposed to be a Buddhist country, right?
And if Buddhism, if we stereotype religions in various ways, we stereotype Buddhism as being so Zen, with all the implications of that. Is this a Buddhist genocide against Muslims?
It would be a little unfair to blame this on Buddha. We certainly don't we tend not to think, as you say, about radical Buddhists or Buddhist extremists. But it is true that the population is overwhelmingly Buddhist, and that there really is a religious dimension where you have Buddhists oppressing Muslims. I talked to a number of Buddhist priests about this, and they are some of the people who are particularly gung-ho in this ethnic cleansing or in this genocide. I should say that there are many Buddhists who are aghast. The Dalai Lama has spoken very forcefully about the slaughter of the Rohingya and has condemned what is going on, but his sect of Buddhism is not the sect that is practiced in Myanmar, and so he does not have much influence there.
You talked about being disappointed in Aung San Suu Kyi. I'm curious to get your take, since we've talked before about your interest in China, where you've spent time, on how disappointed you are in Xi Jinping. I happened to be in China around the end of 2012, around the time he was being elevated to leader, and was on a tour for journalists, and I got to speak to academics and business people and others who were kind of optimistic. And I looked back and saw your column from 5 years ago, and you wrote, "Here is my prediction about China. The new paramount leader, Xi Jinping, will spearhead a resurgence of economic reform and probably some political easing as well. Liu Xiaobo, Nobel Peace Prize winning writer, will be released from prison. So I'm not citing this to embarrass you. Seems like a lot of
did not age particularly well.
A lot of people were wrong about Xi Jinping. So I'm curious what you think happened that turned out that he turned out to be such a hardliner and is now making himself president for life.
Yeah, and I mean the worst part about it is not just his grasping for the presidency for life and effectively becoming an emperor. Really, the worst part of it is that he has presided over this really harsh crackdown over the internet, over the legal system, lawyers and judges, over dissent, over journalism, over what websites are available. And so previously, former Chinese leaders like Deng Xiaoping or Jiang Zemin, I think, had a vision in which they would gradually, over time, become more like Singapore or Taiwan, that the Communist Party would remain dominant, but that they might use elections to get a little more legitimacy, elections among favored candidates. And that now seems to have completely disappeared. And Xi Jinping is a strong man, and he doesn't want to allow any free space. I must say, though, that having covered the rival of human rights and democracy in so much of the rest of Asia, from South Korea to Indonesia to Mongolia, Taiwan, I think that Xi Jinping is going against larger forces of history, and that when you make people richer, when you make people more educated, when you give them choices about what kinds of tea and coffee they eat, then eventually there is pressure for a more open political system. But it can be quite a wait.
Not a straight line. Let me touch on a few of your other recent columns. On guns after Parkland, you wrote a column, How to Reduce Shootings. And in part of that, you wrote, the liberal approach is ineffective. Use a public health approach instead. What's the difference?
So, I mean, one of the problems has been that when liberals like myself propose different measures, then the upshot tends not to be new legislation, but rather millions of new guns sold by gun owners who are manipulated to think that people are going to come and get their guns. And we do have really an excellent example of a dangerous product that we have figured out how to incorporate in our lives and make a lot safer, and that is cars. And so, I mean, whenever I write about guns, I hear from gun owners who say, oh, you know, nobody takes away our cars, even though they kill about as many people as guns do. No, but we really try very hard to make cars safer. And since 1921, we've reduced the auto fatality rate per 100 million miles driven by 95%. And, you know, we've done that by regulating who can drive a car, by requiring insurance, by designing better roads, by having better bumpers, by airbags, seatbelts, a million things. And no one thing was transformative, but we really tried to take this public health approach and rely on evidence. And in the area of guns, we're even denied the evidence because the NRA has blocked research into gun violence. And so we lose one American every 15 minutes from gun violence. We don't really have nearly as good a sense as we should about how to reduce that toll.
Another of your recent columns was in quiz form called What Poisons Are in Your Body? And there were some very common items on that list that might surprise people, like cash register receipts, liquid soap, vinyl shower curtains, and Colgate Total toothpaste. Also canned food. Briefly, why did you single out one brand of toothpaste?
Well, that's actually the one brand that still has a something called triclosan in it that is a endocrine-disrupting chemical. Endocrine disruptors are a kind of chemical that mimic hormones and that often confuse the body into treating them as hormones, and they seem particularly problematic for that reason. Canada and Europe have regulated them much more effectively. The U.S. has deferred to industry, and the result is that industry can spew endocrine disruptors among us, and we don't really even know where those chemicals are.
And cash register receipts, you know, for people working at the register, this is probably where our concern should go, right? Like, we remember that the original smoking in restaurants ban under Mayor Bloomberg was a workplace safety measure. It wasn't so much for customers who could go to other places. It was because the workers have no choice but to work, you know, in one place or another. So do customers have enough exposure to register receipts to be concerned too?
Well, you know, one of the problems is we don't really know because most of these chemicals haven't been rigorously tested. And so there, you know, there'll be some animal tests, there'll be some human tests, there'll be red flags that arise. And then what typically happens is the chemical companies will take out the old product that alarms people, and then we'll substitute a new chemical that is a cousin of the problematic one, but that is completely untested. There's this mistaken view that chemicals in these products around us must have undergone safety testing, and in fact, you know, that's not true at all. The vast majority of them haven't, and so we don't really have a very good sense of what the risks are at what quantity, and that. That creates a real problem for all of us as consumers.
We just Go ahead. Did you want to say something?
One toxicologist was telling me that the real problem now is that you kind of have to be a PhD toxicologist to figure out how to reduce your exposures and how to make yourself safer. And you know, that's not what consumers should have to do.
New York Times columnist Nicholas Kristof. His Sunday Review piece on the genocide taking place in Myanmar against the Rohingya people and what can be done about it is very much worth reading. His fourth trip in 4 years to Myanmar to keep covering this story, which is so easy for it to fall off our radar screens with other things closer to home, always feeling so urgent. Thank you very much for coming on and talking about that and other things.
Great to be with you, Brian.